You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In Marjorie Garber's marvelous book, The Use and Abuse of Literature, she discusses it's a very old phrase, to have literature. Not to write literature, but to possess a deep understanding of literature. And I don't know how many of you were here when Carlos Fuentes spoke here a few months ago, perhaps, and to hear him talk about Cervantes and Akhmatova, Borges and Rabelais. Rabelais, just in one sentence, was to know that the man had literature. And I think it's safe to say that both Marjorie Garber and David L. Ulin have literature. They're both immersed in the writing and reading of it, the study of it. They're engaged in a cultural critique of the place of literature in our culture and in their own lives. And we're fortunate to have them both here tonight, both known for their depth of insight into issues about literature. After their conversation, they're going to invite you into the discussion so you can be preparing those questions, and we'll circulate a microphone as we do record for podcast. Marjorie Garber's new book is The Use and Abuse of Literature. David L. Ulin's latest book is The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. And both Marjorie and David are good at asking questions. Why do books matter in a distracted time? Why read literature, Marjorie Garber asks. Why listen to it on audio tapes or at poetry slams or at the theater? Why buy it? And even if you enjoy reading literature, why study it? You might also ask, is literature still a path to moral improvement and spiritual growth? Can realistic fiction and drama, as Brecht believed, be agents of social change? And who decides what good literature is? Last night, we hosted a conversation. I know some of you were here, between a theoretical physicist and a poet. Poetry, said our poet guest, has no practical purpose, but it does have the potential for spiritual and aesthetic fulfillment. She said, science can only postulate, not know the existence of an alternate universe. Through literature, we can know an alternate universe. And the critic Gautier, as Marjorie Garber points out, asserted that nothing is really beautiful unless it is useless. So what is the use of a discussion about the use of literature, and what are we discussing? And why does literature have to defend itself? So these are some of the array of the questions that our two distinguished guests tonight may address. And again, we will be inviting you into the conversation after them. Marjorie Garber is the author of 16 books, and she's edited 7 collections of essays on topics from Shakespeare to literary and cultural theory to the arts and intellectual life. She's currently the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of English and Visual and Environmental Studies at Harvard University and chair of the program in dramatic arts. Her book, Shakespeare After All, was acclaimed as one of Newsweek's 10 best books of 2004. David L. Ulin is book critic of the Los Angeles Times, and you may have had the recent pleasure of reading some of his pieces on James Cain's Mildred Pierce, on E.L. Doctorow's short stories, the best all-time baseball books, Huckleberry Finn, and Keith Richards. From 2005 to 2010, he served as the Times' book editor, and he is the author of several books and the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology. Following the program, both of our authors will be signing their books tonight, which are sold courtesy of our library store. Please join me in welcoming Marjorie Garber and David L. Ulin. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, good. It's on. Thank you all for coming. This is the first time I've done one of these without the mic stands, which I kind of prefer.
You can hide behind them.
You can hide behind them, exactly. And I don't like having a thing on my ear. But we will, as Louise said, the basic setup is Marjorie and I are going to talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll turn it over to some questions from the audience. So feel free, once we do that, to jump in and ask us whatever you like. We're having a conversation, but I think I'm going to sort of be the traffic cop, I guess. So I thought we would do, just to sort of set a context without assuming that people have read both of these books necessarily, would be to kind of have us each sort of just talk a little bit about what the books are, what our what our points of view are as a context setter, and then we can launch in. So Marjorie, do you want to start?
Okay. My book is called The Use and Abuse of Literature, and it's about why literature doesn't need to be useful to another discipline in order to be central to how we live and how we think. It wants to restore literature to the center of critical thinking and to restore literature to the place that it's had for such a long time. I talk about things like what isn't literature, how literature is always contemporary, how criticism and literature construct one another. I'm very interested in what I call literature as a first-order phenomenon, that is to say, not dependent upon its reference to history, not dependent upon that. Sometimes we develop our notions of character types or of historical events from the literary descriptions of them rather than the things to which they refer. I'm especially interested in the question of literature's primacy as opposed to its adaptation and its use in other fields. My argument over and over again is that literature doesn't necessarily need to solve social problems in order to be deeply valuable for human life and human living. That in order to read in a literary way, and my definition of literature is a very broad one, in order to read in a literary way, one asks questions rather than seeks answers, and the question leads one to another set of questions. So that's the kind of book that I've written.
And my book is basically, it grew out of an essay I wrote for the paper when I was the book editor, and I realized that I had become immensely susceptible to electronic distraction to the point where I was having trouble reading, or trouble sitting down and closing out the noise and concentrating on reading, which seemed like an awful position for a book critic and book editor to be in. So I decided to write what I was concerned would appear to be a public letter of resignation, but turned into something else, and I thought that in terms of thinking about these questions, I was really trying to solve a problem for myself. What is the nature of my own relationship to a contemporary moment, my relationship to reading in a contemporary moment that seems occasionally antithetical or more than occasionally antithetical to what I can, to sort of the quiet or contemplation that I think reading requires. And for me to sort of look at that question, I thought it was useful to go back and kind of retrace my reading life in a certain way, to think about and write about why reading was initially important to me, what the relationship was, and I think of it very much as a relationship, as a very intimate relationship in a certain way. Perhaps what its uses were to me, although its uses were not necessarily always aesthetic or literary. I was saying, we were talking backstage, I'm hoping we didn't leave all of our good stuff in the green room.
We'll go get it later.
But I was saying that when I was a kid, I read almost as a kind of, as a way of learning how to live. I was very interested in the stories and characters I was reading, both for their aesthetic value, but really also for their experiential value, and that was a huge thing for me as a young reader. And so that's I trace that a bit, and then talk about the sort of electronic age and my own susceptibility, because I don't think I say it quite this bluntly in the book, but as I will be glad to publicly admit here, I never really got past that bright, shiny object stage of child development. So I'm always one of these people who's like, what's that? What's that? That looks really cool. And that that quality of distractibility, I think, is something that reading always has helped me kind of keep at bay in a certain sense, although that's not necessarily the use of it either. So, I'm sorry.
No. It's not that we're seeking the use of it. It's that we live within it. It creates worlds for us.
Right.
And it's certainly been useful to us. I wouldn't argue for a second that literature is useless in the sense of let's get rid of it. But rather, it doesn't need to be applied to another circumstance. It doesn't have to be... I'm thinking, for example, of the use of, for example, Shakespeare's plays in business schools, where there are whole books of case studies used in business schools right now in which corporate deciders get to decide whether Prince Hal, Henry V, made the right decision or the wrong decision in estranging himself from Falstaff. If you had a coworker who was misbehaving on the job but was an old friend, would you separate yourself from him or not? And to use literature in this way, which is often the way, in fact, business schools, law schools, medical schools, use literary examples as case studies. They're great examples. Why wouldn't you use them as case studies? And nothing bad happens to these books or these plays as a result of this. They're not ruined. They're not distorted. Nothing bad happens to them at all. But I don't think that we need to seek that kind of instrumental use in order to say that it's essential, not only valuable, but essential.
Would you classify that as an abuse of literature then?
No. I take this phrase use and abuse from, of course, Nietzsche's famous essay on the use and abuse of history for life, where what he's looking at is history monumentalized or history made into polemics and all things that sort of move history into a category other than being vivid, vibrant, and with us now. And this would be my question too. So if I had to reduce this to one sentence, and then you can all listen to David for the rest of the 45 minutes, I would say that. Oh, please! I would love that. I would say that use is often an abuse, and abuse is often a use. That figurative language is technically an abuse of language. That is to say, it makes a figure of speech out of language, a metaphor. Turns language, twists it, moves it in a certain kind of direction. There's no such thing as literary language that doesn't, in fact, use language in a creative way, make new phrases. Maybe that's what we look for. So the usefulness in the mere instrumental sense is what I'm a little bit resisting. Remember that I teach in a university where the question of why should you major in literature comes up.
Well, increasingly now, right? With budget issues, there's an increasing emphasis on the, you know, the quote-unquote practicality of education, right?
Exactly. So that in a way, I mean, how did I come to write this book? Partly because I wrote Shakespeare After All, which was a book about every Shakespeare play, and I thought this is so deeply pleasurable to write intensely and intensively about texts that I've been teaching and reading my whole life. How can I prolong the pleasure? How can I keep doing this in a way? And so the book is a set of readings, really, among other things, because I was, as I suspect you were too, educated at a time when one read really long historical sweep of things, starting very early and never ending. And for me, again, I mean, I think associatively anyhow, and I think by analogies very often. So I like to compare something from the medieval period to something in the Renaissance to something Victorian. And I was teaching a course in metaphysical poetry at Harvard last fall, and I found, and I love these poems. This is why I became an English major, actually, because I love these poems so much. And how did I get to them? I read T.S. Eliot's essay on Herbert Grierson's edition of the Metaphysical Poets, and that sent me to the poets. But I was teaching these poems to my undergraduates and loving it, and I think they were too because they're grand poems, fabulous poems. And I found myself thinking about poems in other periods by Tennyson or by people that you would not normally compare to Donne or to Herbert.
Right.
And so for me, that's part of the pleasure, is to have literature in the way that we were discussing, so as to be able to use it indeed, but to use it to talk about literature. And also to talk about life, of course.
Right. Well, it's like we were saying before. It has an intrinsic value, but it has no the word that you used.
Instrumental
value.
I mean, it does in certain fields right now, but it need not have such a thing in order to be valued, valuable, important, essential. Can I tell you a little story?
Please.
An eminent administrative personage at my institution some years ago gathered together a bunch of people in fields different from the eminent personage's own field in order to learn something about what they do. And I went to a very pleasant dinner for humanists and then a very pleasant dinner also for artists because I was chairing an art department. And the first question asked of the humanities people, so these were the literature people and the history of art people and the philosophers and the linguists, was what kinds of problems do you solve? And exactly, well, a hush fell over the assembled at the table, and we all looked at one another, and I piped up after a while. I said, well, we already have a small problem here because we actually don't solve problems here in the humanities. We love our problems. We keep revisiting them for thousands of years, and every time we come close, well, what are they? Love, death, grief, loss, we
The only problems that matter.
So every time we think we have come to some accommodation with these, we reopen them up and look at them from another perspective, whether it's another critical perspective or another disciplinary perspective or another temporal, historical perspective. So we keep these questions open because they are open questions. They are the questions that make life worth living and worth thinking about.
Right.
But I think that my questioner thought this was charming, but maybe not what a discipline was.
Right. It's interesting because apropos of that sort of lineage question you're talking about, when I teach memoir writing, I always make students start with St. Augustine.
Right.
Which to me is the beginning of the lineage in a lot of ways, that first sort of self-conscious first-person narrator. Mm-hmm. If you read that book, much of what he's wrestling with is immensely contemporary in terms of, you know, this meaning and consciousness and all these sorts of things. He's wrestling with those problems 1600 right. years ago that we are still wrestling with, that no one has come to a satisfactory conclusion about. No one is going to come to a satisfactory conclusion about.
Also, he writes pretty well.
He writes really beautifully. And it's a great narrative.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
all there. It's a great story.
Yeah.
What better story than a sinner reclaimed in a certain sense? It's classic.
I had a friend who was a director for a while of soap operas. This wasn't his principal job. He was a novelist and a bunch of other things, but he spent some time directing soap operas. And he found himself using the plots of Greek plays and the plots of Shakespeare as the underplots for soap opera actions because they are the best plots.
Yes. My wife, who teaches theater, high school theater, was teaching a unit on commedia and ended up showing Marx Brothers movies because mm-hmm. she said, look, they basically, this is a direct lineage. They
Absolutely.
Took everything from there. And you can see it's the same argument. But I think that idea of this as a kind of living heritage in a certain sense, that we keep replaying over and over and over, it speaks to me, it speaks to my kind of sense of what being a human is, because it feels like that's what we're doing also. We're replaying these things over and over and over.
I'm glad you mentioned the Marx Brothers, because it's certainly not the case that it's only the old texts that are the great ones and that we are getting worse and worse and worse or making a Xerox of a Xerox. Sometimes a contemporary formulation actually is the most stunning or the most, or speaks very particularly.
Right.
And one of the things the Marx Brothers have that commedia has is timing.
Brilliant.
Is the pause, the piece of text that is not readable. And this is something that when I have students memorize things, they learn that the silence or the pause or the suture is part of the writing and the reading process, that what is not said, what's left out, or what moves over to the next line is a great poem by Robert Graves that I talk about. In the end of my book is called The Impossibility of Closure, and it's about things that don't end and why the literary discussion doesn't end. And I think it's there, maybe, where I talk about this wonderful poem by Robert Graves called Leaving the Rest Unsaid, which I don't know if any of you know, it's a wonderful poem, which ends in the middle of the line, and the last line says, at a careless comma, and then there's a comma, and then there's nothing else. And it's a kind of pictograph in the way that a Herbert poem would be a pictograph, a hieroglyphic, of the thing that it's describing. And these are the kinds of problems that poets have. When Yeats writes a sonnet called The Fascination of What's Difficult, he writes a 13-line sonnet. Well, that's a clever thing.
Yes, yes. The other thing that I like that's good about the Marx Brothers, or one of many things that's good about the Marx Brothers, is they are a perfect example of something you talk about in the book in terms of literature, which is how definitions get changed, right? The Marx Brothers made those movies as sort of commercial comedies and with without any necessary sense that they would have any kind of lifespan. And now here we are 85, 90 years later still talking about them, or 75, 80 years later. Not only still talking about them, revering them as kind of classics. You talk a lot about that in the book, about the question of what is and what isn't literature
right.
and how those definitions change. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that question as well.
Sure. I think some of these are very well-known examples. The novel, for example, Dickens writing for money, and he writes chapters, and they come out in many of them in periodicals, and you wait for the next chapter. The same way that I can't wait for the next episode episode of The Good Wife, for example, and that you see a teaser and that you really wish that it was happening sooner, and there is Dickens, I was going to say typing, but of course he's not typing, scribbling away, trying to produce this. The plays of Shakespeare and his contemporaries famously were baggage books, riff-raff, they were the Pope,
from the Bodleian Library.
Bodley explicitly said, I'm building this library, but you cannot put any play text in it. They are trash. So this is the baseline, but between Dickens and Shakespeare, these are the models of what we think of as great literature today. So that there's a certain kind of optical blind spot that we have about evaluating the work of one's own time. We can say it's very good, we can analyze it, absolutely, but what will last, what will be remembered, and sometimes it's just happenstance that Eliot review of Grierson I was mentioning before, John Donne was just about out of print for 200 years. And Grierson collects the Metaphysical Poets and publishes this edition, and it's reviewed by T.S. Eliot. And he writes a stunning essay, which is well-published and well-read, and suddenly the new critics are all reading, not only reading the Metaphysical Poets, but developing a critical apparatus that is superlatively well-suited to looking at metaphysical poems, to looking at ambiguity, to looking at naughty language, to looking at metaphysical images that compare science and the human heart or things like that. And a whole apparatus of criticism is developed in order to address a certain kind of poetry which has been represented to the reading world after many decades of Victorian poetry, very different. And so, I mean, criticism really does develop, but my chapter on poetry really wants to say that poetry or literature begets criticism, and that criticism sometimes begets, that is to say, that you develop a poetics of analysis in order to deal with the artworks that you're presented with.
Right, but I think so much of it has to do with kind of, I guess, literature, or how we think of literature as a reader's art as well as a writer's art.
Right.
Because we're talking about how readers interact with the material and reading in a literary way. I mean, this is a concept that you talk about a fair amount in the book that actually I wouldn't mind having you elaborate on slightly for our audience so we can use that as a baseline, because I'd like to talk a bit about that. And because I'm really interested in the idea of reading and writing as a very, as the fundamental interactive act.
And as versions of the same, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
So let's not forget to talk about intention, which fits into this category as well. But when I talk about reading with literary attention, what I mean is just what you would think I mean. Attention to language, to characterization, to echoes of other works, to mythic or generic structures, to a sense of the form of the thing. And it doesn't have to be something that's in the literature section of your bookshelf that does this. I'm longing to teach a course at Harvard, and I have not yet proposed this to the general education program, but they will hear from me shortly on this, on reading the daily newspaper, in which what I would like to do is to bring that literary attention to looking at the LA Times, to looking at how things begin and end, at where the personal example comes in, at what happens when two columns put side to side actually comment on one another, when the authors of, or the writers of these columns didn't intend this juxtaposition at all. There's an advertisement in the middle. What does that actually, what kind of dialogue does that visual thing have with these? What kind of style fits on the sports page for something? It seems to me that you can learn a tremendous amount by reading whatever it is people happen to be reading in a literary way, and that this does not restrict you ultimately to only reading newspapers or to only reading pulp fiction, but it often brings people back to St. Augustine or to other things that we think of as literary classics because they're really good and because they're deeply pleasurable to read. And deeply pleasurable to read often means susceptible to a kind of discussion or analysis or taking home, gee, that's just like something I was thinking about. When sometimes something you were thinking about is something you learned from reading the book.
Right, right. And I think that there's no reason why we have to restrict literary intention or a reader's literary attention to one type of writing or reading. I mean, all of us read, I'm assuming, all of us read multiple kinds of work. If you look at my my night table, if you can make it through what's on my night table. There's all kinds of things that, you know, histories, literary novels, detective fiction, science fiction, comic books, whatever it is I happen to be looking at, as well as newspapers, magazines, all of it. Right. And hopefully I'm bringing the same kind of attention to my reading of each of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this doesn't mean that we're leveling out value. Doesn't mean that if we read detective fiction, which I do with great passion, with a certain kind of literary attention. Some detective fiction, of course, is written by people who are also very great writers or translators. Dorothy Sayers, of course, a great translator of Dante and J.I.M. Stewart, the author of all the Michael Innes novels and so forth. There was a vogue, as I'm sure you know, because I know you read these things too, in the early 20th century for Oxford dons in particular to write murder mysteries under pseudonyms, because they were puzzle-solving and character-developing, and they often had a kind of literary twist to them. And it wasn't thought completely proper at that point to be the author of a rip-roaring yarn. I think that we've at least broken that down a little bit.
We seem to have, although I think there's still, you still see certain certain writers who I think feel they're sort of stuck in a corner by virtue of writing. Now, what we now label as genre fiction, the genre ghetto of some kind, which I think is a false formulation, but I think it still prevails a little bit.
If I can say something personal about this, I think that's also true about literary critics. That, I mean, I write about Shakespeare, I write about dogs, I write about academia, I write about cross-dressing, I write about sex and real estate, I write about a whole range of things because they interest me. And for me, these things, there's literature inside every single one of my books, and literature has actually begotten everything that I've written about. But I love the idea that we can range across all these cultural things and find them embedded in literary texts.
Right.
So that I talk about, in this book, when I talk about the writing of biography, and I mention the fact that Virginia Woolf writes three biographies, one of her friend Roger Fry, one Orlando, and one her biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's dog, Flush.
Right.
This isn't the first time I wrote about Flush. I wrote about Flush, actually, in my dog book. But it was really fun for me to go back to look at Flush in the genre biography rather than the genre dog book.
Right.
And to look at it very differently. I mean, I did read what I wrote before, but I had something very different to say when I was trying to think about it as a biography, and also trying to think of Woolf herself as the daughter of a biographer, as the best friend of a biographer, what it meant to be living in that culture in which they were saturated with the idea of reinventing what biography is.
And I think that this notion of reinvention, this comes back to that question, or sort of leads me back to that question of the reader's role in all of this, and
right.
the way that readers are, I think, in many ways, overtly reinventing the texts that they're reading, whatever those texts are, by virtue of what they bring to the text, by virtue of what they've read, by where it fits into their own literary continuum. In certain
Absolutely.
Sense.
No. This is why I'm talking about my book, but you talk about this also in your book that literature. I have a little chapter, or not so little a chapter, called "Why Literature is Always Contemporary,"
right.
And that's because it's read by us. It's read by 21st century people, and we can do all the homework we want to about the 14th century or the 16th century court or the what it was like to be a woman in the pre-Civil War period in America. But still, we may have that in our heads when we read Harriet Beecher Stowe. But we're also going to have our own perspective and our own historical continuum and our own other reading in view. And so literature speaks unerringly, I think, to a wide variety of cultures, histories, kinds of individuals. And a play is a very good example of this because, of course, there's no conducting voice. So it's not true that Hamlet is only about Hamlet, despite the title, that there is an Ophelia point of view and a Gertrude point of view and a Claudius point of view. And that is that you read things from where you are. If we come back, if you read King Lear as a young person, you have one perspective. If you read it, come back and read it again, you may have a very different perspective.
Ideally, I mean, I think for me, the books that really resonate, if I were to offer a definition of a great book, which I don't think I really have, it would be a book or a play or a piece of art like that where you approach it at different stages and you get some completely different experience of it.
I think that's a great description of a great book, actually.
Well, thanks. So we will now institutionalize that as
That's
the description,
right.
As the definition of a great book. Take
the
that
law,
home with you.
Right.
The Yulin Law, right. Because I've found that, you know, when I write a little bit in the book about rereading, and the books for me that have been, there are books that are problematic that I feel that I've lost by rereading them, books that meant a great deal to me when I was young, that when I reread them when I was older, they didn't have the same resonance. There are other books that I have read at various stages that have continued to resonate. And then there are other books, an example, Frank Norris's novel, The Octopus, which I was assigned to read in high school for some reason I can't fathom, at 17, and I did not know anything about the railroads in California or wheat combine wheat farming or any of that, and nor did I care. And then 20-some years later, I was doing a radio show where that was one of the books we were going to talk about, and I dreaded it.
Yep.
I was like a student who did not want to take the course, so I, you know, dreaded it, saved it until the last possible minute, and loved it, and realized I should have never read that book as a 17-year-old. That book was a book that was waiting for me to read as a 40-year-old.
It's so true. There was this notion that they had to teach naturalism, so you read one or two naturalist novels on your way to understanding what realism was. You had to go through, you had to stop off at naturalism before you pulled into the big station of realism, basically. But my example of that would be Julius Caesar, which, at least when I was in high school, was the play that you read in sophomore year.
Right.
And I now have a theory, having written now on Shakespeare for a bit, I have a theory about why it is that Shakespeare was assigned, Julius Caesar was assigned then. And one reason is that in your next classroom, the Latin classroom, you were reading Caesar's Gallic Wars, which I think is no longer what your sophomore in high school is
doing.
So they thought you would have an interest in these characters and know something about them. But, of course, it's also one of the few Shakespeare plays that has very little sex in it, though more than is sometimes claimed. And now, of course, what is taught as early as possible is Romeo and Juliet, which has, you know, a more immediate appeal to young readers.
No, it's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that until you just mentioned that I read Julius Caesar at the same time I was reading Caesar's Gallic Wars.
And The Octopus.
Struggling to read them in Latin. No, that was before.
Right.
This was my grounding. But you're right. I mean, because my son's been reading Romeo and Juliet in high school, and that's been their initiation. Mine was Midsummer, which we were assigned to read in fifth grade, if you can believe
Excellent.
That.
Excellent. Very good.
And none of us understood it, although we did get to watch the Mickey Rooney movie.
Well, a true classic.
A true classic. And for many years, my main appreciation of that play was because of that movie.
It's a brilliant film. Yeah. But that, you know, it's a film of the Max Reinhardt production. And then if you go back and you think about what it would have been like to see that in Germany at the time.
Right.
Also, I mean, it's expressionism. It's remarkable. And it makes the play political long before it was fashionable to make it political.
That's actually a really good point. It also brings back this question of contemporaneity, I believe is how it's pronounced. I'm better with words on paper than I am with words in spoken language. But I do think that that's another thing that fascinates me about reading is the way it exists in time and the way that creates a certain kind of empathy. Jane Smiley, in her book on the novel, talks about the notion that when she reads Pushkin or Dickens or George Eliot or whatever, that she is not only reading for the narrative and not only reading for the character stuff, although that's part of it, she's also reading for those little details of what it was like in the street and what that world looked like. That's actually something that fascinates me about Augustine, the descriptions of life in Carthage in 355 AD, which is, you know, which is something we're not getting too many firsthand narratives about. So for me, it's both that it's always contemporary, but that it also kind of stretches out and pulls us out of time in a certain way. And there's a real double vision or a double-edged sense of time in a certain way.
It's binocular. It's absolutely that. And stereoptical. And for a lot of people for a lot of years, for example, how they knew about the War of the Roses was by reading Shakespeare's plays. What do we know about Richard III? It's only fairly recently that literature has not performed that historicizing function where you learn about the, you know, Russia through Chekhov or through Tolstoy. These were for many, many years the baselines of how one did, I can't say understand, but get a notion of what such things were like. And at the same time, historians, of course, were for many years and still are writing in a very literary way. So that if you read Michelet or you read Simon Chama or you read, I mean, it's not as if historical writing can't also be profoundly literary in terms of its pacing, in terms of its characterization, in terms of its, so it's not just the facts, ma'am, it's something else.
Right, and all of that, I mean, I think, you know, most kids who are attracted to history because of the stories, because of the narratives. And narrative remains, I think, you know, I don't think reading is particularly at risk either, and we should probably talk a little bit about that. But even if reading is desperately at risk, I don't think that narrative is at all at risk. Narrative is, yeah. I think, a kind of, you know, biological imperative in a certain sense. It's how we make meaning out of the world. And I think that all of those things, I mean, going back to what you were saying at the beginning about the application of Shakespeare plays or literature towards practical purposes, business school, etc. I know that Columbia University recently opened a program in narrative journalism. In narrative medicine. Narrative journalism, actually.
Narrative medicine,
sense,
but right.
In,
right.
In narrative medicine, yeah. Yeah. Which also makes a kind of sense to me, but that sort of, yeah. That application, that filter of narrative, right. To things that we don't necessarily automatically consider narrative disciplines is an interesting, it makes an interesting case for the primacy of narrative.
And for reading in literary courses, case studies like Freud's, for example, right. Which are very literary in their way. A doctor does do a case history, and it is a history, and it right. Is a case. But it's not that practice is only interesting or only readable in a healing discipline or in a discipline that is connected to a hospital or a law court or something like that. Lawyers have to tell stories. They precisely have to arrange things in such a way that they have a narrative point, a conclusion. And this means emphasizing some things, de-emphasizing other things, which is exactly what a novelist does. It's just what a playwright does. It's just what a narrative poet does. And learning that through reading narrative poetry, for leaving that Milton, I mean, Milton's a very good example of how to tell a story.
Right. There was a piece recently, which I didn't read, but I read about. I don't know if any of you guys read it. Someone who I guess is works for the police department, transcribing police reports, wrote about a detective who really writes excellent police reports. Uh-huh. And that was the nature. It was a sort of a critical piece, or a kind of critic's piece, I guess, talking about all of those requirements in regard to this one detective's aesthetic, I guess we can call it.
Of course we can.
In terms of writing.
Or craft.
Uh-huh. Right. So what about the reading question? Let's talk about that a little. I get asked this question a lot, so I'm happy to ask it to someone else. Although I am frustrated by it when I'm asked it, so I hope I'm not frustrating you by asking it. But I often get asked, in the context of this book and just in general, about, you know, the reading in crisis question. In a digital age, are we in danger of losing our grasp on this thing? I don't think so. I'm happy to talk about why I don't think so, but I'm curious about what you think.
I have read you on this topic, and I completely agree with you on this topic, and I talk about it also in my book. I think reading is reading, whether it's on a handheld device on the screen. I myself like the heft of a book. I'll hold them both up, of these physical objects. I like paper, I like pages, and I have the kind of memory that remembers where it is on the page and sort of halfway through the book and so forth. But different people and different generations develop different kind of memory spaces in these ways. I don't find that my students are reading less at all. I don't find that writing tweets is a good discipline. Any limited number of characters is a good discipline for writing. No, it is. It is. And I read something, I think, in the New York Times about someone who took this notion of 140 characters and now imagined a play that had 140 characters in it. Oh. So that you can go. But remember Robert Frost talking about how free verse was like playing tennis without the net, that having some kind of frame is really important, or the exercise of writing a villanelle. I mean, that if a limited number of characters is an aesthetic challenge, how can you get your meaning into it?
Right. And I have a friend who's a poet who started out as a free verse poet in his 20s and 30s. He's, in the last 10, 15 years, has moved back to extremely traditional forms, mm-hmm. Particularly sonnets, mm-hmm. And, you know, full bore structure, right. Rhyme schemes, iambic pentameter, the works. And he says exactly the same thing, that there's something immensely liberating in a certain sense and creatively challenging about embracing those restrictions and using them?
Well, that's one for any creative practice, I think, having some limitation of space, limitation of topic, limitation of verse form or something like that, or of in the case of a painter, it might be a medium of some kind, or an assignment, a commissioned piece. I often find that, I'm sure you do as well, that I write, for me, some of the most interesting things when I'm asked to write about a topic about which I know nothing.
Right.
I wrote a little something about WikiLeaks for the Foreign Policy magazine a couple of weeks ago, and they got hold of me and they said, we'd like you to write something. And I said, I know nothing about it. They said, good, go write about it.
Right.
And I really, it was very, very much, I mean, I did my homework, but then it was really interesting to be assigned something. I think that we all kind of want to be students our whole lives, and that there's something about the assignment that is very pleasing in this way, and that this kind of, it's more than an exercise, but that when a writer writes with one of these disciplinary frames in mind, it's a kind of assignment that they can excel at and get, you know, and then change.
No, I think that's a valid point. I also think that, you know, I mean, you know, it's our interaction with the digital world is still largely text-based.
Right.
You're reading and writing. I found, interestingly enough, just because I get many texts from him a day, that my 16-year-old son is a much better speller and grammarian now that he's actually texting than he ever was. That may be because he has a smartphone and it corrects his spelling, actually. But nonetheless, I'm getting well-spelled texts, which makes me happy. I don't really care why. But I do think thinking in terms of thinking in language, thinking
right.
in terms of pacing, thinking in terms of what you can put in and what you can't put in, are all valuable, and I agree. I don't really care how people read. I just care that people read. I don't. In many ways, I think that the evolution of the ebook is a boon to reading because it's gotten people who are interested in gadgets to pick up reading devices, whether they stay with reading or not. I don't know, but they certainly weren't going towards reading beforehand.
So let me say something about ebooks written by such as we. I'm a trustee of something called the English Institute, which is an annual conference that brings literary scholars together. And for many years, the English Institute essays were published in hardcover, and now they're being published in ebook form.
And are they also being published in hardcover?
No, only in ebook form. And we're just publishing our first and second volumes right now. And the hardest thing for some of the scholars to get used to was numbering the paragraphs. Because how do you refer it? There are no pages. How do you quote something or refer to it? You have to do it by number. And this was for them such an aesthetic shock that you couldn't do it by chapter title, you couldn't do it by subheading. And there was no page number. And they felt as if having a numeral in front of the paragraph was intruding upon the content of the paragraph.
I could see that.
So no, indeed, I can see it too. But so it's getting you. It's either developing a technology that doesn't do that, or getting used to this and not seeing it. After a while, you don't see it because you.
Or you weave the number in as an aesthetic frame.
Exactly, you are Nicholson Baker, right?
Right.
And that too. And so this is just to underscore what you're saying about all these things being in their infancy. We haven't yet done all our bells and whistles with them as creators, even or as technicians.
Or even close. I mean, I think if you see a kind of commercially released ebook version of a book, it's largely a data dump. And few publishers are thinking about them as, I have a friend who runs a small press, she calls it they're thinking of them only as a transparent container. Rather than thinking of
right.
what the form is, what the design of the container is, as well as what the content is. And I think that as we continue to develop, we are really at this kind of primordial stew moment where we will, you know, where we're sort of, it's all in evolution. But as we continue to develop it, we will start to think about the container, the electronic container.
Right.
We already are. Some. You know, in certain instances, this is already underway. And as that container begins to be conceptualized, you'll start to see a lot of these, there'll be solutions to these problems that will be organic to that box, right?
But it's never a container. I mean, it's always, I mean, reading is always translucent, not transparent. There's always a screen of some kind. It is language. It is style. What you're experiencing is some kind of filter. You're experiencing a version of something.
Right.
Not reality out there. Yeah, and it's better. It's not worse, but whether it's the form of the sonnet, whether it's the physical book, or whether it's the literary style, there is something to look at rather than through there that
yes.
seems vitally important.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that it also ties into that question in terms of, you know, that it is both something that we use to withdraw from the world and also to connect
right.
with the world. In the book, I talk a bit about when I was young, I would always bring books with me to family functions because I found the books more interesting. And I would always, not always, but often my grandmother, who was deeply offended by this, would say, you know, why don't you put the book down and talk to the people in the room? And I would say horrible things to her, like, if the people in the room were as interesting as
right.
the people in the book, I would be glad to do
right.
that. But,
right.
But there was this sense of both of those things taking place. I was certainly using it to withdraw from the people in the room. But I was also engaging with this. This comes back to what we were talking about earlier as well, about learning how to live in a certain way. I was directly engaging with those people, with those situations in the book. It was not at all a matter of seeing through. It was a matter of kind
right.
of climbing in.
And even historically, some of our archetypes of what we think people are like come from literature rather than from direct observation. Shakespeare's women were all written by the playwright to be played by young boys.
Right.
So our notions of classical femininity, whether it's Juliet or Rosalind or Ophelia, are based upon parts that were written for male performers.
Which is why the role reversals in the comedies are there, or partly why they're there, right?
Well,
why they were easier to play.
They were easier to be, but they were also self-referential, pointing at the medium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what great literature often does, is reminds you that it's a novel. There's a novel within the novel within the novel, or there's a poem within the poem within the poem. And that awareness of that self-reflexiveness of literature, that's its awareness of itself as an artifact, is not artificial, except in the old sense of artificial, that is, a work of art. It's one of the things that makes it, again, worth rereading and re-experiencing.
Now, in the book, you talk a little bit, and we're going to turn it over to questions for you guys in a couple of minutes, but you talk a bit about the risks of reading, in a certain sense, or reading as a as potentially the dangers, you know, that books can be dangerous. We talked a little
right.
bit about this before as
right.
well. That it's not, you know, that there is a kind of sense among reading advocates that reading, you know, why is reading good for you? But that reading also has
couldn't be good for you if it wasn't also bad for you.
Right.
I mean, if it would be banal and uninteresting if it weren't also galvanizing. Seductive, persuasive. This is why Plato was nervous about poets. This is why Renaissance playwrights wound up either in jail or with their ears clipped or their noses clipped.
Right. Or why in totalitarian regimes writers are always the first to go.
Books are banned.
Yeah.
It's that capacity to be banned. Then we did talk about this a little bit. That is an example of how people have felt about the dangers of reading and books. And one thing I do talk about in my book are things like Ulysses or The Well of Loneliness, books that went through court cases. And I really talk a lot about how the judges read them, became literary critics and read them, because what saved them from being banned was that it was decided that they were literary.
Right. That was their redeeming, well, except in the way
redeeming social
they're
value.
Redeeming social value.
What does social mean here?
Right. But in the case of The Well of Loneliness,
right.
Has anyone in this room read The Well of Loneliness? Okay. That's good, actually. That's a pretty good percentage. Did anyone who read The Well of Loneliness think it was a well-done book? Okay, so
there's a tendentious question.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was a leading question.
Right.
But I am leading
right.
the question because that does establish
right.
the problem or the question of the well. I mean, not that it should be banned in any way, but that this was one of the legal problems or legal questions in regard
right.
to the trial of the well.
And very many eminent people went and testified in favor of it for political reasons and reasons of aesthetic freedom, who had a hard time saying, as Virginia Woolf had a hard time saying, that it was really a good piece of literature.
Right.
But she felt very strongly, very passionately, that it deserved to be published and to be read, and that the minute you started banning books, you were destroying civilization.
Right, which I firmly agree with. But I do think that the other question which it leads to, and maybe this will be a good way for us to end and to bring you guys in, is that question of empathy. Because whatever else the Well of Loneliness does, it creates, she does create empathy for the situation, for the characters and for the situations to some extent. And maybe by virtue of being so, such an early, I guess a protean lesbian novel is how we would call it,
an early lesbian novel.
And by virtue of sort of, again, its own contemporaneity, I think I pronounced that correctly, it has stuff around it that that encourage our empathy, even if the book itself doesn't completely or even largely work.
Well, I think that one of the things that people found, that the period found disturbing about it, was that it implied that there was sex going on.
Yeah.
It wasn't only about a subculture, it was also about relationships. And that night they were not divided. Is that how it ends? Something like that. So that there's sort of dot, 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 that sort of, you know, talk about the conclusion in which nothing is concluded.
Exactly.
In Act 6, something is happening.
Comma at the
right,
end of
exactly.
the graves poem.
Something is happening.
Yeah.
But every work does that
right.
in a way, I think.
Yeah.
And seems to me that that if literature is, or reading isn't, risky, then it really is at risk. Reading is not at risk so long as it is risky, so long as it brings you into it. They're wonderful stories, you know, Paolo and Francesca reading a novel together, reading something together and falling in love. Emma Bovary or Don Quixote reading literature.
And if you remember, in Bovary, you know, the mother-in-law is constantly harassing Emma Bovary for reading novels.
Stop reading that
trash.
Right. Go learn to cook.
Right. Only lead you to ruin, which is
Well, Quixote is the same thing. He reads romances, and then, you know, I mean, but these are texts that are very much aware of, they're very Borgesian in their way. They're very much aware of themselves as performing exactly the activities that are being described as one of the things that the characters do.
Right. And I think, again, that's also for us as contemporary readers, that's what, for me at least, that's one of the things that opens those books up. Because I can directly empathize with the situations, even when I'm not empathizing directly with the characters. I'm drawn in and they become my contemporary moment.
Absolutely.
And they come to life that way. Well, thank you. This has been really, this has been great. I've enjoyed this thoroughly.
Fun.
And let's...
The lights go up. There you are.
Lights go up, so
yes,
we can see
okay.
you. There are microphones floating around, so if you raise your hand, you will be called on. And please feel free to jump in.
You said something a little bit ago about historical fiction and that the use of certain novels to teach history. I think that there are still really compelling historical novels that do give an entree into history, like Philippa Gregory's The Other Boleyn Girl,
mm-hmm.
Or certainly Catherine Stockett's The Help is going to serve that purpose even a few years from now, in getting people to understand what a time period was like. And we have teenagers, and so they are reading Lord of the Flies, which is about a certain period of time,
uh-huh.
and they had to read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
And Julius Caesar
yeah.
still in the curriculum. But what I wanted to ask you, what I'm seeing and what I experienced myself still in the education of children is, what would you say to the English teachers, because they all love literature, what would you say to them to help them get across their love of literature and the literature that they have to teach for California schools curriculum, so that the students love it as much as the teacher does?
Well, just what you say is what I do, and I think what every person who teaches literature does, is when you're teaching people for whom these things are new, you teach your own enthusiasm. You say, isn't this fantastic? Look how this phrase works. Look at this metaphor. Look at this figure. Look how this repeats something that we saw on page one. Isn't that brilliant? And so you share your own enthusiasm, but you share it not by just saying, wow, 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 but by also pointing at things and teaching a practice at the same time that you're teaching your own enthusiasm. I was taught those same books in high school, and I would actually, once I finished my course on the daily newspaper, would like to teach a course on those books to college students, because I think that the readings of those books have been so frozen in time that my guess is it would be really interesting to reopen them up and to do 2 weeks on To Kill a Mockingbird, do four different readings of it, and not to merely revisit older readings or familiar readings, because defamiliarizing a reading, reading against the grain, is often a way of making yourself newly interested in a work, and to show something about the power of the literary work itself, that there isn't only one way of reading it. There's not one meaning, there's not one interpretation, there's not one way of interpreting, and that a variety of ways of interpreting can and that doesn't take away the value of the work, it actually enhances it. So I think if teachers, I mean, high school teachers work very hard. They see lots of students, lots of times during lots of days. And sometimes it's very difficult to keep up that level of enthusiasm. But I would say, again, start small. Start with a sentence. Start with something small.
I think that's an excellent point. Actually, I frame this book by talking about my son's struggles to read The Great Gatsby in high school. And I think that for him, who is very much a reluctant reader, I would say start small. I think that it was overwhelming. The critical apparatus, the question of critical apparatus was overwhelming. So I would say go back to the source of the enthusiasm in some way, which is the original reading. And I think there's a way to bring in that critical apparatus and a requirement to bring in that critical apparatus. But after I wouldn't make it the first thing. I would make the story the first thing. And sometimes I think that can get lost too, especially with class sizes and the number of students that teachers are seeing and the course loads and also the requirements.
My question for Marjorie Garber, which of all the novels that you've written, all the books you've written, is your favorite personally, or most personally important to you, and why?
Oh, gosh. Okay. This is the first of a number of evasive answers I'm doubtless going to give. I'm often asked, I think by analogy, so I'm going to give you an analogy first. I'm often asked by my Shakespeare students, which is my favorite Shakespeare play? And I always say, the one that I'm teaching right now. And so I would say, on that model, this one is my favorite book. They've all been extremely important to me and very valuable to me. And as as I've been walking around over the last couple of weeks talking about the use and abuse of literature and meeting people who are reading it and who are buying it, I sometimes also have people, I'm sure this happens to you too, who bring copies of other books that they have just bought or have read and would like signed or something like that. And I find that immensely, immensely gratifying. And very, very occasionally, I actually even reread my work and find it surprising.
This isn't really a question, but I wanted you to know that you're not the only literatis who enjoy Groucho Marx. There's a collection of letters written, an exchange of letters between Groucho Marx and T.S. Eliot. And they were to meet, they were arranging a meeting, and they eventually did. And each of them said, you can't imagine how upset and nervous I was about meeting the great Marx and so forth.
The Harpo Speaks. Harpo is my favorite. So Harpo Speaks is also a phenomenal book. They were very smart, literate guys. You know, Groucho's books are good, too.
This is just an observation. I just wanted to say thank you very much. And I'm a high school English teacher, and I teach Huck Finn to AP English language students. And by now, they've been to college, and they come back having read it in college, and they tell me how much they enjoyed it the second time. And Bo and I have been teaching it long enough where the same kids have read it in graduate school, and they come back and tell me how much the book has changed. And I think that's interesting. And, of course, yeah. they say it with a wink in their eye because the book hasn't changed at all. In context, they have changed over the course of 12 years or so. And I like to think that the reality of life-changing circumstances and everything, the books enable them, it gives them the scaffolding to deal with the changes that come up in their life.
I completely agree with this, but I would also say that sometimes the work actually does change, even though all the words remain the same. And my classic example of this is The Merchant of Venice, which really does mean something differently after the Holocaust to most Western readers. It's very hard to read it without having contemporary history in view, even though no word of the text has been changed. I would say with Huck Finn it's very similar, that all the work that's been done since Twain wrote that book, and all the work that's been done on slavery, the work that's been done on the South, the work that's been done on American regionalism really has changed a little bit how the work means, even though the words on the page remain the same. And for me, this is a good thing. I mean, we don't lose the former readings ever, but we do gain more and more kinds of readings. And when David was talking about how readers change work, these are very, very evident examples, but there are other examples that might not have to do with race or religion or politics or gender, that also where the times have changed, and so the work changes as a result.
Yeah, I think that's interesting about Huck Finn. I mean, given the sort of uproar earlier this year about the Baudelaireized version of the book that was published, a lot of that came up, and the question really is, what does it mean to teach? For me, the interesting question was, what does it mean to teach that book now, as opposed to what it may have meant at other points? I'm not calling on people. So.
First of all, you guys are really lucky to have a job where you get to read and that's your job.
Don't tell anybody.
You know,
the work police will come take us away.
A lot of us, you know, have jobs where we can only read in spare moments. I've just finished a book called All Things Shining, which was written by one of your colleagues, I think, plus a professor at UC Berkeley, talking about how literature has reflected and changed human culture. You start with a chapter on Homer, which is followed by a chapter on David Foster Wallace, which is followed by a chapter on Moby Dick, and you talk about St. John, and there are certain sort of iconic figures that these two writers point out that they recommend. But what the problem they posit is the David Foster Wallace nihilism seems to be the dominant form of current literature, and how do we get out of that? What's next? And I'm wondering what you would recommend to readers as the next transformative author that's going to write the next Moby Dick, who I guess when he wrote it said, I wrote a wicked book and I feel great about it, you know. And David Foster Wallace, who ended up deciding that he had to hang himself because he couldn't write anymore. What? Give us a couple of books to read for those of us who don't have a lot of time to read books, even though our stacks might almost be as big as David's.
Well, I think if you're talking about contemporary fiction, probably David's the person who should tell us. I mean, I have my favorites,
First of all, I do think I don't think David Wallace was a nihilist, and I don't think he killed himself because he couldn't write anymore. I think he killed himself because he had a disease. But I think actually, if you read his work, I mean, as early as the early '90s, he wrote an essay essentially against irony. Writing about television and other things, but basically saying irony is not enough and that we need some kind of, we meaning his generation, which is also my generation, need to return to a kind of way of writing about true feeling that we've been so inculcated by growing up in the culture we grew up in with television, with pop culture, to sort of be smart asses and to kind of shine off or shine on actual emotion. Nobody wants to really write about romantic love because it's corny, that we have to kind of figure out a way to organically and complexly embrace that and write about it. And I think that that's one of the things he was trying to do. As far as the sort of transformative writers now, I don't know that I really believe in that concept, actually, because I think it's hard to say. I think in terms of the contemporary moment, it's impossible to know sort of who those transformative writers are going to be. I mean, even Melville was, you know, unemployed, and or not unemployed, but, you know, was working in the customs house. And
not a classic in his time at all.
Broke and out of print, right, until the book wasn't rediscovered until the 20s.
Right.
So in that sense, I think sometimes those books are, they exist, and we either, we find them later, or our children or grandchildren find them. So all I can talk about are books that I've really liked recently. So I'll just, the titles, I just, in fact, for this coming Sunday's paper, reviewed, what's it called, You Think That's Bad, by Jim Shepherd, his collection of short stories. Shepherd's a guy who teaches at Williams, who's published, he was a National Book Award nominee for his last book. He's a brilliant short story writer, I think, because he's all over the map. He embraces pop culture. He embraces history. This is a book of 11 stories, some of which are contemporary, one of which is narrated by a page to Gilles de Rais, the French madman who murdered countless number of young, mostly young boys in his castle. Their stories set all over the place. In terms of chronology, in terms of location, he's really adventurous. But there is something really deep and enduring, I think, about what he's writing about. He's writing about fundamental human themes, those sort of themes that Marjorie was talking about. In his case, really about intimacy and the difficulty of intimacy, connection, disconnection. What happens when we're up against it? How do we maintain our humanity when we feel like we're at the end of the line? And frankly, some of his characters do, and some of his characters don't. It's a terrific book. It just came out. You know, I feel like now I'm doing advertising for this book. But that's a great, it's called You Think That's Bad by a guy named Jim Shepherd, S-H-E-P-A-R-D. He is a radically underread and underappreciated writer in this literary culture. He's been publishing books for about 28 years, a bunch of novels and a few short story collections. I don't only mean to talk about short stories, but the other thing that actually, again, to play off a phrase that Marjorie threw out, the other book, which is also a collection of short stories that I read earlier this year, which is called Binocular Vision, by a Boston writer named Edith Perlman, who has published 3 small collections that have won some small prizes, but most readers don't know about her. But this is a new and selected that just came out in January. She's another writer. I'm really attracted at the moment, and this may change, but this is just where I'm, where my mind is going now, to writers who are writing about very small, particular moments of human interaction. And that's really what Perlman does phenomenally well, the kind of the very subtle social interaction. There's a great story in the book about, it takes place in the 70s, it's narrated by a 15-year-old girl, and it's essentially about her parents' synagogue. The Torah study group is really just a beard for a weekly poker game that her parents and the rabbi and the cantor all play at. And it's her observing the adults and watching what happens and, you know, watching these very subtle gradations of interaction and who's looking at who in what way and what does that tell you. And it's a really interesting portrait of just a kind of an adolescent kind of coming to adult awareness of how the world works. She operates on that kind of very minute particular level, and it's really gorgeous stuff. So I would recommend those two.
Interesting to compare that to Philip Roth's early story called The Conversion of the Jews.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
Where, again, you know, looked at the other way around, what is being claimed seems to them, you know.
Yes, right. And those early Roth stories, I don't think anyone really reads them.
Though they're wonderful stories, those early Roth stories. Yeah. Fantastic.
And they're the only stories you ever published.
Let me recommend something else, though, because your mention of the National Book Awards reminded me that I was the chair of the nonfiction panel for National Book Awards this past summer. And that meant that I and my colleagues read 500 books. And every day, boxes of books arrived and so forth. And we read in them. We didn't finish every one of the 500 books. But we ultimately gave the National Book Award for nonfiction. So interesting to me that the category that Americans read most is called non-something. That as if the norm is fiction. And nonfiction, you know, is biography and self-help and memoir and recipe books and every possible thing. Lots of war books and lots of Obama books. And as you may know, we gave the prize to Patti Smith's Just Kids, which I really love. It's a beautifully written book. And again, it's very spare. It's as brilliant for what it leaves out as for what it puts in. We do not hear about Mapplethorpe's illness. We do not hear about his early death. We don't hear about how they become famous. It's a slice of a moment, and it's extremely compelling and beautifully written.
And I will say, as a fellow admirer of that book, it's as well done an argument for the value of art and creativity and the value of bohemia in a real sense, in a culture that seems to have lost sight of that value. And the value, even going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, of sort of education as exploration, whether formal education in a university setting or the kind of less formal education that Smith and Mapplethorpe engaged in, their art education, but education as an act, as a process of exploration rather than as a process of training. It's a really, really great statement of what we're sort of overlooking in our current cultural moment.
It's also a great love story.
Yes.
So, I mean, it would fit into a lot of categories and would be teachable if one were to teach it from a lot of perspectives.
We have time for one more. We have time for one more question. So if there is one more question.
Hi. I went and bought your book knowing I was going to come today, David, and it was the last book at Borders, a Borders that was closing down. And this guy took me to the corner where I got the very last book, and it was all the way slid in the back. He said, oh, they're all gone, and he pried in there and pulled it out. And it was, growing up in the relatively the same neighborhood, the whole experience was of reading it was very intimate and wonderful, and that, you know, like someone who loves love, someone who loves books. But also there was kind of, it was a kind of sadness, like a Billie Holiday kind of sadness having just come from Borders. And I don't know what's at risk, but it feels like something is. And when you were talking about the container, and Marjorie was talking about having to number the text, and when the printing press first came out, how typeface became important, and the form of the book and the paper. And I think that that's something that may be coming up and may be important. I just wanted to know if that's where you were going with when you were talking about the container.
Let me backtrack for a minute. I think that things are being lost, no question. And bookstores are sort of, I don't think bookstores are going to disappear either. I just think that the landscape is adjusting or is shifting. I think there will be far less bookstores, just like there will be, already are, far less newspapers. I don't think that that means that those things are going to disappear, but that they're going to have to interact with the world in a different way. And I think that I think that the vast expansion of Borders and Barnes & Noble was a terrible idea 20 years ago, and that in some ways the demise of Borders, not in all ways, but in some ways the demise of Borders has to do with corporate overexpansion as much as it has to do with the kind of demise of bricks and mortar bookstores and the collapse of a kind of infrastructure for print reading. But that said, whenever a bookstore goes out, it's a bad thing. As far as the container, I mean, I do think in some ways that we're in a moment that is not unlike the Gutenbergian moment. And I think that what you saw, or what you know, if you look at the history of sort of the development of movable type, that was a big shift also. And it changed the nature of how we interacted with books or interacted with written or printed language. And the availability of printed language, and it changed. I mean, that question of typeface and all of that. There was a real consciousness about the container. In the early, the earliest printed books, they didn't use the same typeface necessarily throughout the book because they wanted to duplicate the variety of handwritten pages. So I think that I'm probably not answering the question exactly, but I feel like we're at such an early stage in knowing how this container works and what it is. I don't think we even know what it is yet, and how it interacts with those other containers. I don't think that the print book is going to go away. I think we will read, different people will read different things in print and will read different things digitally. and on different kinds of devices. And I just don't think we know yet what that is. I think that in some way, my inner 19-year-old, my cynical leather-jacketed inner 19-year-old, would be appalled at the kind of optimism of my no longer 19-year-old. We'll just leave it at that. But I do feel that it's the content. There's a relationship between the content and the container, but in the end, it's the content. And what I am committed to and what I don't see going anywhere is the kind of survival of long-form reading and writing and the kind of engagement and contemplation that is required by dealing with long-form reading and writing. So in that sense, it's hard for me to lament a container, the change in container, as long as the content is there to fill the new container. I feel like I've carried this container metaphor way too far, so I'm going to just stop now. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
Oh, okay. I mean, so let me just say very briefly that I think one of the questions is access and speed. That, again, we're in the middle of something. The Google suit is something that we have to think about. I had a correspondence. I was giving a talk last week at the Harvard Bookstore, which is the wonderful independent bookstore in my own hometown. And the guy who owns the bookstore had read an interview in which I had talked both about the importance of the neighborhood bookstore and also about the fact that I buy books from Amazon. And he wrote me a very nice note saying, you know, Amazon is what's driving bricks and mortar bookstores out of... And so we had a correspondence about this. And I said, for me, it's not price, it's speed. If my graduate students are working on something, if I'm doing something where I want to read two or three books in order to do my writing and I can get them tomorrow, that's really what I want. And when I'm told that it can be ordered and it will come in 7 to 10 days, the moment will pass when I need those things. And so this problem will get solved. It'll get solved through downloading. It'll get solved through print on demand. It'll be solved sometime in the next 10 years, probably.
I think so.
But I think we're in a shifting moment right now where the neighborhood bookstore, which once upon a time was a place where you could get together. The one thing that Borders and Barnes & Noble did well was the cafe idea. The idea that, again, books and eating and drinking and talking were friends. But I completely agree with you that the superstore notion was never a friend of the book.
Right. Yeah, and I think that... And I agree. I mean, I also buy books from Amazon, although I support local bookstores. But, if I'm working on a piece and it's a tight deadline and I need a book tomorrow... Or if I discover I need a book at 11:30 at night, it's extremely convenient and very useful to be able to get it right
away. I needed the postmodern poo in 24 hours in order to complete my WikiLeaks piece, and I wasn't even sure the Harvard Library had it.
Right. And if you have an electronic device, you can download it instantly, which, again, I mean, it's convenient, it's useful. It's not my preferred means of reading, but I have certainly... bought books electronically that I needed, I mean, literally for a piece or for some work-related thing, that I needed to read right now. I needed it right then, and I could have it in 30 seconds or 60 seconds. It's hard from my point of view to argue with that. It's not the only way I want to read books, but it's an amazing thing when you need it. So,
but don't forget the library.
Right.
Again.
And really...
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.